Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be looking at the year-end bestsellers and the sales for the 12 months of the year. This is part two of the 2017 Mayo Report Year in Review episode. For this, I got Sam, TJ, Eric, and myself together, and we talked about both the comics and the trades. As you can imagine, that was a lengthy discussion. You've hopefully already heard the comics section in the previous episode. So with this, we're going to join the conversation. I'm going to replay the intro just in case you didn't listen to that, so you can know who everybody is. But we'll continue the conversation as we jump into the trade side of things. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top-selling comics and trades for all of 2017. As you can imagine, that's going to be a lot of data, so of course, I need a lot of co-hosts. So joining me for this year-end episode from the Monthly Mayo Report comics episodes and the TV ratings episode is Sam. How you doing tonight, Sam?
Good, how are you, John?
I'm doing all right. But we're also going to be talking about trades. Can't do that without having TJ from the Mayo Report trades episodes. How you doing tonight, TJ?
Doing well, John.
Cool. And joining us for that retailer perspective and stuff from the Cowcast and Cowabunga Comics is Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Starting with the top trades for the year, once again, we've got the top 1,000 items. I've got another 88 items below that, again, from the indie, the small press, or the manga list, or whatever. We've talked already a little about how things are fairly different on the comic side of it versus the trade side in terms of number of publishers, shelf life, things of that. The other thing I find dramatically different here is how quickly we go from where that top item is, whatever it may be, down to more, I don't say realistic numbers, but more common numbers. We'll go with that. The top-selling item of the year was Saga Volume 7 trade paperback with an estimated 47,775 units, which is ridiculous. It's amazingly good. That's something I would say is, you know, leaps and bounds beyond expectations. Reasonable expectations, at least. What I find interesting is when we go to the next item, it's 29,415 units, and that's reorder activity of Volume 1 of Saga at the $9.99 price point versus the $14.99 price point of the Volume 7. So we've already got, what, a 18,000 unit gap there between that first and second item in terms of what they've sold over the course of the year. Obviously, you factor in complete reorders and everything for the Saga of Volume 1, it's going to be a very different picture. And then we've got a smattering of things here, but it's not too long. I think at item 12, we're below 20,000. By item 43, we're below 10,000. From there, the drop isn't quite as fast, but it's a bit more, I don't say stratified of a list, but it's a different dynamic here. The other thing that's very different, we talked about how, again, on the comics side, it was predominantly Marvel and DC. We've already talked on how there's, like, over almost four times as many publishers on this list as on the comics list. But most of these top items, most of the top 10, is Image books. We've got Saga, we've got Walking Dead, Paper Girls, Monstrous, Walking Dead, Here's Negan, and Seven to Eternity.
Yeah, I actually would be interested to hear Eric's take on this, because I think another aspect of Image's success, and especially in the direct market, is over the last 5 years, they've proven to comics retailers that their books will move units. And then because it's a non-returnable market, it's such a trust game, right? So you guys can only order, you have a limited amount of budget, and you can only order to a reasonable extent what you think you can sell. And over the last 5 years, especially the top line titles for Image have proven that those are strong sellers. My local retailer has literally one whole like bookcase that's just Walking Dead. It's literally stocked to the gills with trade paperbacks, hardcovers, every version of Walking Dead collected edition you can imagine, and that thing is always packed. And I know that he's constantly rotating through that. So I think that's why you see these charts, is that added on set success that the retailers over time see that that's successful. They're willing to take a chance on some of the other ones by creators that aren't as well established, and you kind of see the snowball continues to roll downhill for Image.
Yeah, I think we experience consistent sales with Image books, but only for what you see reflected in this list, known quantities for the most part. So your Sagas, your Walking Deads, Paper Girl by Brian K. Vaughan, obviously. Monstrous has been out for a couple of years and is something that has gotten widespread acclaim. So, and Marjorie Liu has, and Sana Takeda have done other work before, I think at Marvel specifically. So they're not unknown quantities. 7 to Eternity is on here. That was one that just got rave reviews across the board. But then you go back to Walking Dead, then you go to Saga, then Monstrous and Paper Girls. So, I mean, you're really hitting the same creators and same titles over and over again. Now, each area of the U.S. is probably going to have a different regional spin. So for us, one of our biggest sellers is Revival. It takes place in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Tim Seeley was in our store. That's going to be huge for us. But what I think to me, so to answer your question, TJ, yes, we definitely see a lot more continued sales on Image titles specifically in a trade format. And a lot of that has to do with price point. When you're talking about $9.99, $14.99, that by far beats a DC book at $16.99, and it definitely beats a Marvel book at $19.99 or $24.99. So we're definitely always seeing people willing to take a chance on Marvel or on Image books more so than they're willing to take a chance on something else. Additionally, when people come in that have never read comics before, we pretty much always walk over to the Image section of our trades, or I should say the independent section of our trades, because the likelihood, unless they come in and say, I want to read Batman, the likelihood of us thrusting them into a superhero universe that has years of continuity and back matter to try and either understand or ignore tends to be a little difficult. So we end up finding, you know, we'll ask them, what kind of movies do you like? What kind of TV shows do you watch? What kind of fiction or nonfiction prose do you read? And from that, we kind of develop an idea of things that they like. Now, there's definite go-tos if someone, you know, says they like crime noir, but they want to be in a superhero universe. Well, all right, we'll walk ourselves right over to Gotham Central or something like that. But by and large, with new people that don't necessarily call it superheroes, we're taking them over to books. And it almost always ends up being in our independent trade section, 95% of the time it ends up being Image. There's no doubt about it. They're the preeminent publisher with a wide variety of non-superhero based books that have a lot of baggage with them.
Yeah. And there's so many easy jumping on points. You know, most of the series are, you know, pretty continuous, you know, start at one, go to two, you know, there's not 30 years of renaming and renumbering which Spider-Man volume is this, yada, yada.
Right. Right. Now, the one thing that I think is really telling on the chart here is you've got Saga Volume 7 in the first position with almost 20,000 units more than Saga Volume 1. I went back and looked at what Saga Volume 7 did in its initial month. In its initial month, it did 22,900. That means that over the course of the rest of the year, I think from March on, there were 24,872 reissue purchases or reorder purchases. That's massive. Mm-hmm. That would put it, if we were just to put that alone on this list, that would put it in the fourth spot. That would put it above Paper Girls and right under Walking Dead 27. Yeah. I mean, that is the kind of power that Paper Girls has. Now, we see it slipping, you know, a few hundred issues here or there, and not really breaking much ground in the single issues department at this point, but that's because people have moved to trade on it.
Oh, absolutely.
They are so devout and dedicated to BKV that they will read pretty much anything.
Yeah. Well, and for myself, because I'm exclusively a collected edition reader, but I read Saga in the big hardbacks, which only get published like once every 3 years. So, but you know what I mean? Like, there's even more sales there, right? People converting down the line from singles to the trades to the hardcovers. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got completists that will buy all of that. I have a coworker who owns all of the Saga trades. He gets the hardcovers. With Walking Dead, he has the trades, the compendiums, the hardcovers. I mean, there's just people that want every format of the book because they love the property so much.
So with Image, do you find the $9.99 price point on the first volume, I would imagine that's a really big selling advantage. You can talk somebody into it of, hey, it's under $10.
Absolutely. And especially when you look at Monstrous Volume 1, I think there's like 7 issues in that book.
Yeah,
it's unreal.
It's over 200 pages. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah. You cannot beat that value, not to mention the quality of creator work that's in it. It's just, it's just, it's insane. And so, yes, it's absolutely easier for us to bring a $9.99 book to someone and say, hey, not only is this a jumping on point, but the cost of this trade is equivalent to the cost of essentially three single issues. And by the way, you're getting double that in this book. It's a no-brainer.
When they take it, they buy it, they read it, they come back, and they want that next one. Do they flinch at all at the price on that second volume?
Nope, they're in hook, line, and sinker.
All right, so at that point, they've been sold. Price is less of an issue at that point, because again, it's $14 or $15 versus $10 or something.
Correct.
Interesting, okay.
And also, John, I think it's important to exactly what you just talked about, them being hooked. Partly why these storytellers are so successful, you know, Brian K. Vaughan is known for it. His last page of the last issue is always like a cliffhanger. These creators are very successful at drawing you in and want you wanting more. Right now, obviously, a lot of them do it to try to get you, you know, if you do it from trade one, they try and leave that cliffhanger on the end to get you to go to the single issues so you don't have to wait, you know, 6 more months for the next trade. But these writers and artists have proven they're very successful storytellers. And so obviously, you know, if you get someone into a $9.99 trade and then it's Brian K. Vaughan or it's one of these other creators that are very good, Jonathan Hickman, they're very good at telling stories. And so obviously if someone really likes that, they're going to be willing to pay a few extra dollars for that next trade.
Right. And just to kind of go down that rabbit hole a little bit, Brian K. Vaughan in particular is absolutely phenomenal at that. And you go back to his work in Vertigo on Why the Last Man. One of the things that we almost inevitably always see is if we give someone the first volume of Why the Last Man, within the next week, they have come back and bought all of them. And the funniest part is that they will buy them all one at a time. They will come back 2 times in a day to buy them because of how well they are written. And I had a coworker that I lent my copies to. In 3 days, he came back with bags under his eyes and he just looked at me and he was cursing me. And I said, what the heck is wrong with you? And he's like, you made me stay up until 4 this morning because I could not stop after I finished volume 3. And he read volumes 4 and 5 right after it.
Wow.
I mean, to your credit, to Brian K. Vaughan's credit, he just has a way of hooking you and holding you on for the story. And there's a lot of other creators that do that too. I mean, like you said, Walking Dead's the same way. Now, that's actually something I wanted to talk about. We have noticed both single issues and the trade sales of Walking Dead have started to take a slow dip for us. And what we've kind of surmised is it's not people switching over to Amazon. We're just starting to think there's becoming a little bit of fatigue with the property in general. And the fact that the TV show has deviated in some instances so much farther away from the comic than it used to. And then also just the tone of the book has changed a little bit that some people are commenting that they feel like we're just carrying on for the sake of carrying on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that Brian K. Vaughan is very good at is he has an end game in mind and he stops it.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that I think will be interesting to watch in the next year is what are the Walking Dead sales like? Do they continue to slowly dip down? Do they level off or go up? I mean,
yeah,
it's just something we've noticed.
Yeah. And well, it's interesting to think too, because Walking Dead is on volume 28. And so you see it's for certain people, it would be hard to sustain that much story momentum for that long. But then you look at other forms of entertainment in completely different places, like volumes of manga. And manga, you know, like if you look at One Piece, they're up to the, you know, into the 80s in the volumes. Now, it's a completely different kind of proposition, and they have hundreds of characters that they kind of do side stories on. But it's just interesting how maybe the Western comics medium, there is not the ability to go that long. You know what I mean?
Well, I think at 28 volumes, it becomes a much more intimidating title to start.
Yeah.
Walking Dead, something else is going on with. The viewership of the television show is down significantly the last 2 years. I know personally I'm less interested. I can't put my finger on it, but something in that particular book just, I don't know. It feels like it's dragging or it's gone on too long or something.
Well, if you look at both Walking Dead Volume 27 and Saga Volume 7 came out in March. Saga had almost 25,000 units of reorder. Walking Dead only had 6,700 units of reorder. I mean, that's a big difference. That's a huge difference. And I would assume that Walking Dead Volume 1 is going to be on this list somewhere. Curious to know where that is.
I would imagine. That's going to be your...
It's at number 25.
Okay. Because that's going to be your indicator as to how many people are essentially jumping onto the book.
It's in rank 24, row 25. 24.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
14,000 units.
Right. So it's, I mean, you still have people jumping on, but the follow through is starting to wane.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take another Image title here on the trades.
Okay.
That is by another author who's been around the block, is well respected, well received, I think, generally, but who isn't sitting here up at the top of the list. And frankly, it surprises me a little how far down I had to go to find it. Lazarus, down at rank 193. With 4,583 units for Volume 5. This is Greg Rucka. This is Michael Lark. These are the guys who did Gotham Central. Rucka has done Queen and Country. He's done Wonder Woman recently. He's done a lot of things. Is he doing something? Is he not doing something these other guys are? What would you attribute the comparative lack of success?
He's not publishing his Image books because he was on Wonder Woman. He just lost momentum. That's what it was. I mean, same thing with Black Magic, which is down in the 500s. To me, that's really what it is he just wasn't putting out anything in Image, so there wasn't much draw to it.
Yeah, I think it was on. It was a little bit more on the art side. Michael Lark was taking a little bit longer to make. You know, at the beginning, maybe they had a decent amount of ahead of time. He was working on it before they were releasing the first issues, but he got to a point where it was taking him 6 to 8 weeks or more to make an issue. And so you started missing months and things like that. And that is for, you know, the pamphlet, that's kind of like the death knell. That's one of the things that Kirkman, at least recently in the last 5 years or so, has been very good about. You know, I knew that there were delays with Walking Dead early, but you know, now that he's making so much money, he could, if you look at the title, if you look at the credits page for Walking Dead, he has someone do everything. There's even someone probably bringing him coffee in the morning, you know, but he has the money to do that. So he keeps the train running on time. And I think a lot of these series, that's a problem.
Even with the earlier days of Walking Dead, like around issue 40 or something, when it was kind of chronically late, Kirkman at least had the work ethic or whatever you want to call it, that there was one month that three issues came out in 4 weeks. In an attempt to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
So even before he had the level of success he's got now, where he could afford to do some things he might not have been able to do as easily back then, he was at least cognizant of, hey, I'm behind and this is a problem and I've got to do it. He's one of the few creators that I think has totally owned up to that and mm-hmm. course corrected very successfully.
Yeah, I think with Rucka, I think you've got a couple of pieces at play. I think part of it is because he spent a lot of time on Wonder Woman this year, and he had his artist Nicola Scott, who does Black Magic with him. The last trade they put out was in April of 2016. So Black Magic Volume 1 did show up on this list. It's item 521, and it had 2,407 units of reorder. So if you think about it, for a book that's been out for 20 months, that's actually not that bad, considering that no fresh content has come out in a collected format. I expect that we'll see when trade number 2 comes out, we'll see more activity with trade volume 1. The other piece with Greg Rucka is each writer that you have writes in a different style and a different tone, and that resonates differently with people. And when you talk about Gotham Central, you have to remember that Ed Brubaker was a part of that as well.
Ah, fair point.
And I think when you look at how Brubaker writes, he kind of gets into that gritty noir type feel with stuff. And I think that makes a difference in how people perceive things. Now, Killer Be Killed Volume 2 came out, and that's up at rank 87 at 7,000 units. So you can't correlate Gotham Central specifically to Greg Rucka. Granted, you can't correlate it specifically to Ed Brubaker. It's a shared written component mm-hmm. there. So I feel like there's a little bit of a difference. And Rucka tends to write more from a feminist point of view, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. I love his work. I love a lot of the things he does. And he takes that stance proudly. He wants to make sure, you know, with Lazarus, with Black Magic, that there's a strong, and Wonder Woman, obviously, there's a strong female presence. I'm not saying that people dismiss it because of that, but there are some people who that just doesn't appeal to them as much, and so they may jump off quicker and not make it to trade, or they may just not be interested. Likewise with John, with you specifically, that you have certain tendencies in comics that you don't like. You don't like hyperviolence, you don't mm-hmm. like excessive gore, so it's no different than that. So I think that there's just different pieces that play differently. And there's nothing right or wrong about that. It just kind of is what it is.
No, absolutely. It was just striking me as, here's another author that is on par with Brian K. Vaughan and some of these other names we've been bounding around that are at the top of this list on Image. And, you know, Greg Rucka, granted, you know, Black Magic went on hiatus for quite some time while he was doing Wonder Woman with Nicola Scott. Lazarus was still coming out. Granted, they've had that miniseries with other artists and such. It just seems like there's, and to your point of other writing styles and other things factoring in, there are other things at play than just be a known A-list creator or whatever, do a book at Image and you'll do well.
Yeah, correct.
But there is a lot of Image stuff on the list. There's like, I think, 188 or something items thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of what I find makes, for me, going over the trades a lot more challenging is there's a lot more stuff on this list that I don't read versus on the comics list. Because again, like you were pointing out, I have my wheelhouse and I'm comfortable in it. I do a lot of superhero stuff. I don't read as much Image as some other people. Certainly Drew reads a ton of it compared to me. Whereas I'm much heavier into the Marvel and DC stuff than a lot of people.
Right, right.
It does surprise me a little bit if we go with that 3,000 number of brick and mortar stores potentially out there, how quickly we get to the point where there's maybe two or three copies on average at a store on some of these things. And for things that are reprints, that doesn't bother me. For things that are kind of the pro forma, it's had six issues, we must release it in trade because, well, we can. You know, I don't worry too much about those, but I would have liked to have seen more items a little higher on the list here than we tend to. And even some of the items we're seeing up here are either perennials or older material, be it Watchmen or, again, that first volume of Walking Dead, things of that sort. I think it's a more even playing list, playing field here on this list, but you're not only competing with what the other publishers are doing right now, like you're on the comic list, you're competing with everything else those other publishers have done and ever collected almost, and they can keep in print. So I do think there's a different kind of an uphill battle on this list versus the comic list for new items.
Sure.
Well, I was going to say, John, going down a similar vein, what shocks me is just how relatively minuscule these numbers are. Again, there's about 3.6 million units total in the top 1,000, which, yeah, that sounds great. But you assume there's 3,000 stores, there's 52 weeks in a year. Let's assume the average store is open 5 days a week. That's only 4.5 trades sold a day. Average retail price, $22, meaning average sales for your average stores, about $90 a day. Figure a 50% margin. There's a profit of $45 a day per store in trades. I mean, that is zero. I mean, that is such a minuscule part of an already small economy. It's ridiculous.
It almost doesn't seem like it would pay for the person to be working and manning the store that day.
Exactly. I mean, Eric, is that accurate? I mean, do you think on an average day you sell about four trades at an average of $20 a piece?
Well, please hold
while I... See, starts crunching some numbers frantically.
Yeah. Son of a gun.
From my perspective... 5 days a week for a store. Okay, let's go with that, because I think some are open 7 days. Some are, they do the weekend, they just do it in other days. It seems to me that, and again, this is something I'd love to get Eric's opinion on after he's crunched those other numbers. Whew. The lion's share of the sales for a store are going to be pretty much probably on that new comic day, which these days is Wednesdays. At one point it was Fridays, but now it's Wednesdays. You're going to have another kind of spike of sales to a lesser degree either on that Friday, Saturday, as the people who can't come in during the work week come in and catch up. But I would certainly think there's going to be a severe dip in sales like on that Thursday or whatever, unless you've got other things to bring people into the store, such as gaming or other things, like I know Cowabunga, I'm pretty sure, does. But also, you're going to have like a Monday, Tuesday that I would think in most stores is dead. So if you sell a trade on a Monday or Tuesday, in some cases, I think you're lucky. But that's, again, outsider looking in.
I crunched the numbers, and Sam, I was going to say, I don't know if that's really a safe average to say, but I'll be gosh darn, we sell an average of 4.95 trades per day.
Wow.
Now, what I will say, though, is that every store is different. There are some stores, like there's a store in Minnesota that only sells trades. They don't sell anything from a single issue standpoint. It's only trades. And then on top of that, there's stores that will shy away from selling trades because they don't see the turnover. So it's kind of each ultra micro economy is a little bit different. But for us, we averaged five trades per day last year. We're open 7 days a week, and don't let the cat out of the bag on this, but most of the comic shops in our area are closed on Mondays, so we're open on Mondays, and we do some pretty good business on Mondays.
It's one of those things. I get why stores close a day or two a week, just because, I mean, they want to have some time off too, and depending if it's a mom-and-pop store, how many people do they have that can run it? And there are some days that just it's questionable if it's worth being open, based on the foot traffic you may or may not get. But that five trades a day average, that's interesting.
But that doesn't factor in what we sell online and what we sell at shows. We like I said, we got in a ton of those omnibus when they were on sale. And it's one of the things I want to talk about as we kind of go through some of these numbers. But we sold probably about 60% of those online. So that increases the number. Those sales we track differently. Those kind of go into an online sales bucket as opposed to when we scan things into the point of sale system. And then we also do sell trades or hardcovers, depending on where we're at for what shows, knowing what the audience is at that show, we'll sell them there. But in the store itself, yeah, we sold an average of five trades per day.
At one point, and this was six, 7 years ago, I was thinking trades might someday kind of become the primary revenue stream. Since then, it's clearly not panned out that way. From your point of view, does that look like it could ever happen?
In the retail store, I don't think so, the way that the market is currently set up. It would take some big changes on the publisher side to say that we're going to go to more of an OGN model where we have a quarterly release of, you know, some collected trade. I just don't see that happening. And part of the reason why I don't see that happening is because they really do feed upon the week by week momentum of stories, because it's not just publishing the story. It's all of the buzz that happens about the stories. It's all of the review shows, the review articles. It's all of the spec books that get hot to get extra people coming in. All of that momentum carries through to the trades. So when somebody sees, in the case of Seven to Eternity, that every stinking issue, for some goofy reason, nobody could explain why, other than the fact that nobody could get it anywhere because it sold out so fast. All these issues are double, triple, quadruple. Up to, I think the first issue was going for like $80 at one point on eBay. People are going to take a notice and go, what the heck? I guess I got to get on this and check it out. Oh, $9.99 trade. You got it. I'm in. So I don't see the model swaying too much. Now, I will say that there may be a continued shift in a percentage of readers who say, I just can't stand the six-issue story arc business. I just want to read the story start to end, and I'll wait for that trade. But by and large, I don't think a publishing house is going to want to make that change because they lose so much momentum. If you think about all the Batman that you get now, and you were to put that on a quarterly release cycle, that could get really tricky because you're not building as much momentum. And maybe Batman's a bad example because you could stagger the releases. Let's say Batgirl. You get one Batgirl story every 3 to 4 months. You're really not going to have much momentum pushing it forward. And at some point, people are just going to completely lose interest.
So using the serialization as a marketing tactic, essentially, to keep the buzz and the interest alive over a longer period of time, which would explain potentially, you know, something like, again, a weekly release of TV stuff, be it on network shows or even CBS All Access with how they've done Discovery, versus Netflix, where they'll drop like the full season of Punisher. It'll be a lot of people talking about it, at least in the circles I travel in, right around that release, and then nothing since. Right. Whereas if it had been on a week-to-week basis, they might have been able to milk that for 3 months.
Right, but because they're not reliant on commercial revenue, there's no point in getting people to come back every week. They can just tell their story and be done.
You were going to hop in, Sam?
No, I'm shocked looking at the numbers and Eric's kind of, I mean, again, assume five a day, assume an average of $20 price point, assume Keystone margins. I mean, that's less than $900 of revenue a month to cover expenses plus salary. It's like nothing.
Yeah, I think I think there is a pretty big bifurcation, though. I think there are certain stores that sell quite a bit more and some stores that probably don't sell any, and they've kind of ceded that market to Amazon and the like, and that they focus on the pamphlet sales, and maybe they are a store that has gaming and things like that. So, you know, not everyone that has a Diamond account, 75 to 90% of the revenue is coming from comics, right? So they may not need huge trade sales to make a difference. And some of them may not even be focused on trades at all because they just accept that maybe Amazon is going to take that money and it's not worth their effort. You know, I just don't, there's so many stores, it's just hard to say.
One question, Eric, I've got for you is, TJ obviously reads predominantly in trades, if not almost exclusively. I tend to be on the opposite end of that spectrum. I tend to read almost the overwhelming majority on the single issues and such. There's a obviously a few months difference in age between TJ and I. I'm just a little bit older, he said facetiously. Is there an age skewing that you're seeing between the people that tend to be picking up mainly comics versus those that are gravitating more to the trades? Are the younger readers going more trades?
No, I don't think so. I think it kind of tends to be an even smattering. How do I want to phrase this? So I think I'm younger than TJ, which makes me just a touch younger than you, John, still. but in my reading pattern is varied. I get a mix of both singles and trades. But what I will say is when it comes to back matter that is older than, say, 2 to 3 years, mm-hmm. people will tend to lean towards trades. And that's for two reasons. First and foremost is availability of the product. Modern books that aren't a key issue go out of print at the publisher and they don't make another printing of them. Most stores aren't going to keep a glut of recent comic back issues because they don't have the space for it for a product that may or may not sell. Whereas you go into our back issue bins and we've got Amazing Spider-Man's from, you know, probably issue 65 on up and multiple copies of some of them because we know they're going to sell. They're great books. So it's one of those things where the scarcity of the book becomes a part of it. And then if you go beyond those couple of years, most of them are going to skew towards trades because they're going to include some sort of a key issue that could be very expensive. So like reading the Annihilation Conquest, if you were to read the Conquest, it's not as expensive. You're just to read Annihilation. A set of the single issues can be upwards of $150 to $200. So it's pretty expensive when you're talking about trying to track down single issues, whereas you can pick up a few trades for $24.99 and you're good to go. So there's kind of different patterns, but we see a healthy mix. And I think what we end up seeing the most is the dyed in the wool readers are going to stick with the single issues. The new people that are coming into a story midway, say Walking Dead, are going to go back to the first trade and they're going to carry forward. And the majority of the time will stick with the trades. But if a new Kirkman book comes out, they'll jump on the single issue. So Oblivion Song, which I think is coming out in a month and a half or something like that, they're saying, I want the first issue. They want to go into the single issues. So there's no back matter for them to have to try and pick up.
That makes sense. I've had times where if I miss an issue, it seems like it's easier and sometimes even cheaper to get the trade than the single issue I missed, which drives me nuts. But that's the world we live in.
Right.
Well, I think in a lot of cases, publishers aren't helping themselves. All that stuff Eric talked about momentum, in the last 2 to 3 years, I've gone from being like you, John, to probably being 75% trades now. And 95% of that's just the storytelling style. There's no reason to read single issues. It's a much worse experience.
I can totally understand that. Having gotten as far behind as I did over 2017... Over the last probably 2 months or so, both at the end of the year and even as I've gotten a little behind already but since caught up, I've been having some weekends where I'm reading like 200 comics or something. And when reading in that kind of a rapid succession, you can really tell, wow, this one took me a bit of time because there's a lot in there. This one, I started and next thing I know I'm done. Nothing really seemed to I mean, stuff happened, of course, but nothing that mattered happened. You know what I mean? Some things feel really thin because it's written for that trade experience, whereas others, it's much more denser, more satisfying read. And I think that factors in a lot as to, you know, why some people are going to gravitate towards the, I don't want to have to come back six times to get the chapters of the story, just give it to me all at once. I totally get that. I just wonder if I were coming into the hobby now, one, would the hobby be able to grab me the way it did when I was a kid? And what would my buying habits be? Would they be single issues? Would they be trades? Would they be digital? It's such a different marketplace now than when I was getting into it as a young reader.
It's continuing to change too. I mean, we've got one of the things that James and Sam and I work really hard at is when someone comes in that's new to comics, we really try and understand what brought them in here. Was it just on a whim and I want to see what it's all about? Was it Big Bang Theory? Was it a Marvel MCU movie? Was it a DC movie? We want to understand. In some cases, it's like it could be the Batman Arkham video games, but we want to understand what brought them in. And then that helps us to kind of give them a starting point. It's one of the most exciting and frustrating things is when someone, a young kid, whether it's a boy or girl, doesn't matter, around the age of 7 to 9, when they're really starting to get onto reading fully independently, they're starting to grasp onto slightly richer storytelling, things like that, and they want to get started with the stuff that's currently being published. That's really hard to hook them in for a couple of reasons. Number one, the quality of content that's suitable for that age bracket can be a little tricky to navigate,
mm-hmm.
because some of it's written a little too old, and some of it is we kind of drop way down to like 2, 3, 4-year-old books that you're reading with mom and dad. So there's a gap right there of content that's suitable for those ages. And for the content that is suitable for those ages, it can be tricky because there's not a lot. Does it fit what they want? So we do struggle. I'm not going to say that we don't ever get things to them that they want, because there's enough things that we have, but it's a lot harder for those younger readers to find things that are A, what we would deem appropriate for their age group and their sensibilities, and B, is a something that they're interested in. I mean, not every boy is going to want to read My Little Pony. Not every girl is going to want to read Batman the Animated Series. So you kind of have to play this middle game and find out what they really want. When it comes to older readers, one of the things that gets people into stores can be the NPR blurbs that they put out on either their podcast or on their actual broadcast when they're talking about top graphic novels or things like that. That doesn't come up very often, but it's enough to get a couple of people to come in. So, I mean, it's interesting. It's a tricky world right now. The other thing that seems to be lacking is, believe it or not, when kids come in here, we always ask them, do you watch cartoons on TV or do you watch cartoons in general? And almost all of them say, no, not really. I saw the Christian Bale Batman movies. They're like, okay, yeah, you're 10, 11. All right. If mom and dad think that's okay. But it just strikes us as odd because like James is a year older than me and Sam is 3 years younger than me. We're all right around 30 plus or minus a couple of years. And we all grew up on the staples of, you know, the Batman animated shows. We got Super Friends reruns. We got the TMNT first generation animated television series. Things like that where it hooked you in. And then there were books to match that on the shelves. And it was written well. The stories were kind of that done-in-one feel. And there's just not as much of that that we can quickly and easily get out. So it's an interesting time right now.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that because, again, I grew up on the Super Friends when it was on Saturday morning. Yeah. Saturday morning cartoons to me was a huge loss when it went away. But even after that, there was when Fox would do the X-Men cartoons or whatever in the afternoons or things like that in the 90s. Mm-hmm. But even after that, we had Cartoon Network doing some cool stuff with like the Green Lantern cartoon or the Superboy and the Legion cartoon or stuff of that ilk. Obviously, the Batman animated series is and its other title, subsequent series after that are in there somewhere. The last cartoon I kind of clearly recall watching was Avatar The Last Airbender. I mm-hmm. started The Legend of Korra. I never finished it. I since picked it up on DVD. Even that's a good couple of years ago. I would be hard-pressed to name any cartoon that's come out kind of since that's attracted my attention. I mean, I watched Jackie Chan Adventures. I loved that when it was coming out. But that cartoon on-ramp into comics does seem like it's almost entirely gone away.
Yeah, the ones that we typically hear are Teen Titans Go and My Little Pony. Those are the most common ones because they're the ones that have the biggest they have the biggest marketing push behind them, and there's a clear, rather clear gender divide on them. One centers on predominantly boys, one centers predominantly on girls. There's crossover into both, but those are really the big two that we see in here right now, which is different. And I don't know if Teen Titans Go was on this list at all.
Well, how about down at ranks 65 and 66, we've got the DC Superhero Girls, volumes 3 and volume 1, and then volume 2 is further down the list a little ways. How's that property doing for you?
That one we usually get on our pre-orders, and what we get for the shelf in the first go, we usually pull 5 of each in, and 4 of them go directly into pull boxes, and then we will, every time one sells off the shelf, we'll get another one in. And so I'd say we usually go between 8 and 10 in a calendar year per title when it first comes out. So there's enough movement on them. But that's one of those ones where if people don't know where to look to find all the additional content, they're not seeing it, because I think a lot of it is built into the DC Superhero Girls website, which has some web shorts. It's got, I think, a couple of games and other stuff like that. My daughter's just a little bit young for those yet. She's in the 3-4 range, and so we haven't really jumped on too much onto the computer with her.
Mm-hmm.
But those do okay. When it comes to kids' titles, the one, actually I have the list in front of me of our top sellers, the one that does the best is Oddly Normal. That was our number one sold trade, Oddly Normal Volume 1. Now, Otis, the writer and artist, does live in Minnesota, so he's just a 4-hour drive away. But ultimately, when we hand that book to someone, and it's predominantly to parents of girls, but when we hand them that book, they usually come back for trades 2 and 3. So number one was our volume one was our number one seller, and then our 8 and 9 sellers were volume 2 and 3. So that property does tremendously well. Lumberjanes does all right for us. That's definitely taken a huge dip since the original creative team jumped off of it. The writing and the art have changed, and so that's one that we see kind of a little bit of a cooling on.
Interesting.
It's funny you say that, because as John and I talked about in the last comics episode, I've got a 4-year-old daughter, absolutely loves the DC Superhero Girls.
Yep.
And to be fair, I mean, part of it is, daddy reads a bunch of DC heroes, and it's kind of, oh, this is for girls and for me, and it's something we do together. But like I said, she just loves that thing.
Yeah, my daughter is decked out in DC Superhero Girls gear. She wore her Superhero Girls shirt today. She has the dolls and stuff. We just haven't gotten too deep into the reading because she just turned 4. She did see there was a full length movie that they did.
Yep.
And she did see that. There was one part that got a little scary for her, but she saw that and she loved it. And so that's one of those things where that property, I think, can be dynamite. And the other thing that I think is really great with that property is that not only do they have the graphic novel component to it, but they also have prose novels that are written at a younger age, kind of that middle school age. So there's kind of a companion piece that you can get additional stories. And it kind of works two ways. We've had people come from the local bookstore to get the graphic novels from us. And we've had people say, do you carry the prose novels? And we say no, because the bookstore does. And we have a friendly relationship with them, and we're not going to trample on each other's feet. So
that's cool.
Yeah. I think that those highlight the opportunity that some of the companies are looking for. You know, you kind of saw it in the adult coloring book trend that was hot for a while. But also just like for the DC Superhero Girls, I think that there's been numerous articles, maybe on Heidi McDonald's The Beat, and then also in the other comics verse, that those are doing pretty well outside the direct market. And those are probably pretty successful in the Scholastic market as well as the Amazon market, So, sometimes we talk a lot about like Miss Marvel and the Dinosaur Girl one?
Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur.
Yeah.
I know in previous podcasts, you guys had talked about how you're talking about Marvel, some of Marvel's issues, and the single issue sales for some of those comics are very, very, very low. And you did acknowledge that there just may be another opportunity for the company in different markets, such as the Scholastic market. And if they're selling 100,000 copies of Devil Dinosaur and Moon Girl to Scholastic, now obviously they'd be getting a huge discount because that's how Scholastic operates. But, they're just maybe completely separate markets that it doesn't make sense why they're publishing a single issue. But if they're making a lot of money in the Scholastic market and they can amortize some of the costs by publishing the single issue, the business may make sense on that market. And the same thing here, we may not see huge numbers for the DC Superhero Girl, but like you said, there's ancillary things they do on their website. There's, you know, the prose novels. There's kind of like they're touching the direct market with this aspect of it, but they may have a huge other appendage for it in the other markets.
Well, even if something right. like those aren't breaking in the bucks in any particular channel, which I'm sure they're doing well in one of them or whatever, but even if like DC Superhero Girls was just breaking even or doing okay, I would be tempted to keep it going as a long-term kind of outreach program that will potentially pay dividends 5-10 years down the line. When those girls get older and they're going by a comic store or they're at a convention or whatever, mm-hmm. that sort of a property is going to predispose them to Marvel versus DC versus wherever based on what they read as a kid. Yeah. What do they know? What are they? Oh, that's a cool character. I remember this from whenever.
Yeah.
Yeah. The fun thing is my daughter right now seems to gravitate towards Batgirl and Harley Quinn. And I wonder in the future if she keeps on the Harley Quinn thing, what that's going to lead to, because when you think about the titles being published right now, I'd give her Batgirl in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know as if I'd give her the current iteration of Harley Quinn.
Yeah. I can see that.
So, but I mean, I think that what they've done with that property is awesome. And I wish that they would do that a little more broadly. I know that my wife and I, we talk all the time about being kids, and even for her, watching Batman and Superman animated and then Batman Beyond, that's her favorite cartoon that she ever watched. She has all of it on DVD and repeatedly goes back and watches an episode here or there. Things like that were huge for us, and it would be nice to have something like that continue on.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think we need more books that can act as on-ramps for different age groups and such, because I know I was on the Super Friends comic book before I was into the Justice League comic book, and it was a stepping stone, much like something like the Scooby-Doo team-up title could possibly be.
Right.
But there's so few and far, those titles are few and far between.
And I think the other thing, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about how there's not that many, you know, animated shows that kind of draw kids in. I think it just speaks to the more overall complete fragmentation of entertainment. You know, there's so many options now for kids growing up in terms of video games, in terms of everything else. And comics has always had a marketing problem on some level. And it's just harder to keep people's eyes on your product for longer than 15 minutes. And it's a tough environment in terms of entertainment. That's just the reality of being in this market.
That's fair. And let's go with, okay, cartoons aren't what they used to be, but something that is very popular and out there is video games. At rank 104 on the list with 6,307 units is a reorder activity of Justice Gods Among Us Year 1 Complete Collection trade paperback. Now, Injustice Gods Among Us has since done another 5 years, another kind of limited series, and gone on to Injustice 2 based on the second video game. Is it something that is able to act as a good jumping on point? Because to me, that's potentially a really good on-ramp to get somebody from a video game onto a title they may enjoy because of the video game, and from there I think you could, after they've read it and liked it for a while, say, hey, maybe you want to check out the DC Universe proper. Here's another take on these characters.
Yeah, it could be. It's one that we don't really see any movement on in our store, but that doesn't mean that it can't be for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What else do you guys see on the list here that looks interesting, if anything?
One of the things that I just wanted to look at was I filtered out the list by price to anything that was basically greater than $49.99.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, those are Marvel titles. Now, there's a few, you know, in here that are DC, but almost all, if not all of those Marvel titles, not quite all of them, but a good chunk of those Marvel titles that are in the $99, $100, $125 range were all those ones that had those really wonky retail rank numbers when you guys would go through things throughout the year. And I think there was basically two big groupings of them, two different months.
Mm-hmm.
And those were all things that were on deep discount that Marvel was clearing out. So that's why a lot of those jumped down there. I don't think in a normal year you would see thousands upon thousands of these high dollar items moving. Now, DC does have two things on here. They've got the Jack Kirby's Fourth World Omnibus at $150, and then the Swamp Thing Bronze Age Omnibus at $100. Both of those, obviously this was Kirby's birthday year, so it was a big milestone event. So DC went really big on that, and Marvel went big on it too. But DC really put out a lot of stuff for it. And then, if I remember right, the Swamp Thing Bronze Age one, was that right around when Len Wein passed away? That one kind of came out, and that caught a little extra buzz, I think, for that, and up some of the orders. I think so.
Yeah.
It was not planned, but it did work out
right.
That way.
It just happened to be the timing was unfortunate, but yeah. So. But for those Marvel ones, I would say 90% of those are all things that were on the deep discount. A lot of retailers, well, I'm not going to say a lot of them, but retailers that took advantage of it generally took big advantage of it. And for $125 book, we were running specials here where it was, you know, for the 125s, you could get them for $50. For the $100 ones, you could get them for $40. So that was great for us because it was an easy way to make some good profit. And people got some pretty massive goodwill out of it for a huge dollar book at a price that was really easy for people to afford to get that much content.
Now, did you guys see a decent increase in your shipping costs for all that? Or is it just all in the wash? You were able, because the discounts, it didn't really matter.
Well, yeah, shipping is by weight. So the shipping costs did go up for it. But because of how aggressive the pricing was for us to be able to get them for, it was easy to... build that in and still make money on it.
Bake that in, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I think we figure on those bigger omnibus, like the $125 ones for sure, I think we figure it usually costs like $1 or so to ship them. So when I'm just going to pull a number out of thin air, but on a $100 omnibus, if you're getting it for $20, paying $21 for it and selling it for $40 or $50, that's pretty darn good.
That makes sense. I thought it would be more than that. That's actually pretty reasonable for the size of those books.
Yeah, and I think it's because it goes by freight and it goes by volume. So if we're getting 9 boxes of them, you know, for the truck to make one stop to deliver, you know, a third of its cargo, it's pretty cost advantageous.
Gotcha.
Well, and the fact that we've got nearly 3 dozen items at essentially that $100 or more price point on this list is kind of staggering. But virtually all of them, other than the Jack Kirby Fourth World and that Swamp Thing Bronze Age you mentioned, are Marvel.
Yeah, and you can always count on Marvel at least once or twice a year. It seems like they have to clear out their warehouse because they don't want to carry it forward on their books, or they just, you know, that's just their policy. They'll do that. Now, obviously, sometimes it's the omnibuy, sometimes it's just the complete editions or the epic editions. You know, it just varies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they usually have 2 cycles a year where they kind of, one where they go through their trades, one where they go through omnibus and collected hardcovers, like the Stephen King, the Tower ones that are a little bit more absolute-y. And then they also do a cycle, and DC does this too, where they'll kind of flush out their back stock of typically variant comic single issues. And a lot of them are the ones that weren't like the 1 in 500s or 1 in 1000s. They were more of the increase your orders by 75% and, you know, unlock this variant. So they'll put those out there for, you know, $1.50 per book or something like that to let you just clear them out.
Uh-huh.
That seems like it could potentially be a win-win for everybody, as long as the publisher didn't, you know, have too much that they're, as long as they're not taking a bath on the whole thing. And I doubt they are. If it's something that they've just got extra copies because, well, they had to print so much anyways. The fact that you could get some of that at a fairly hefty discount and get it to readers that otherwise wouldn't pay the full price either for an omnibus or one of the variants or whatever, it can make for a happy customer, and that's just good for the industry.
Yep. Now you could argue that Marvel should just lower their prices in general and the industry would be happier, but it's a different discussion for a different day.
No, but I'd be up for that argument.
and I'll be interesting to see, because they've specifically told retailers that we have to be careful how we price our collected editions, because we're, you know, a lot of times from the order sites, you can get 50, just from as a customer, you can get 50% off of a hardcover or a trade. And then if you divide that out by the number of issues, that is quite a bit less than the $3.99 price point that Marvel obviously has, and obviously higher for events. And as you've seen the slow trend towards everything becoming $3.99, and then now events are obviously $4.99, if not $5.99, with extra content, extra pages. You know, as we get closer to the point of $4.99, 20-page comics, will they continue to raise the price of their trades, or will DC and Image's price structure for the trades kind of prevent them from doing that? Sometimes Marvel just seems to do what they want to do regardless. And will it get to the point, you know, Eric, do you see an issue of if $4.99 became the realistic price for a 20-page comic, do you think there'll be more of a switch to trade, or just people drop it? The problem they've always had, they'll have less people buying, you know, books, so they have to raise the price kind of problem.
I think it will depend on what they do with the trade sales. If the trade prices go up accordingly, then I think you'll just see people slow down what they're buying, or they'll shift to a different publisher. Yeah. I think that some people, it's just too much of a habit. It's almost like smoking, where they just can't give it up. So they'll just take their dollars, and instead of buying the pack of Camel, they'll buy the Newports or whatever. You know, they'll just take it a notch down kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine that being part of it. The other thing that I can see is if the pricing structure doesn't change for the trades, then some people may adjust their purchasing to go over to the trades. But, you know, there's a part of me that understands what Marvel is saying, but there's another part of me that says they really shouldn't care about that. All they should really be worried about is whatever they're going to get for their hardcovers, what they're going to get. If their margin, let's just take that Keystone 50%. If they're going to get 50%, what do they care if someone sells it for 51% and somebody else sells it for 99%? It doesn't matter to them. They still get the same 50%. So it's kind of like, just back it out. The thing that I think Marvel should be a little bit more cognizant of is where their cinematic universe is driving towards with the Infinity Gauntlet, and the fact that the Infinity Omnibus has been out of print for a couple of years now and is selling for $300 to $400 on the secondary market. If I had that in the catalog to order, I'd have three of them on the shelf, and I guarantee you I'd sell two of them easily.
Yeah.
You know, so there's lost money right there. So if they want to dicker over $5 on a price of a book, yet they can leave $300 to $400 out there to dry, there's a problem with their focus. And that's kind of a concern that a lot of us have. And the same thing with Annihilation. We can get, well, heck, the Annihilation Conquest was one of the deeply discounted omnibus this year, but you can't get Annihilation. That's a $200 to $300 omnibus right there. It's another one kind of important with the Guardians of the Galaxy stuff going on.
Yeah.
Seems like some definite missed opportunities. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that we've conveyed.
Unless the goal is to push everybody to the unlimited service. Because they're all there.
Yeah, I was going to say, instead of going to trade, if comics got to where they're all, you know, $4, $5, $6, if the price keeps going up, there comes a point where I'm going to have to think, do I keep getting the print or do I go to the digital? Because
there's a lot of people that have commented that if it goes to digital, they'll just read their back issues.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is that's what Marvel has done to me. Like, I generally find their trades overpriced. So I just read everything on the Unlimited app, and then for series that I particularly enjoy or ones that I will read over and over again, then I'll get the Omnibus, or I'll get the oversized hardcover. Like, my favorite Wolverine story is the Old Man Logan, and so I got that in the hardcover, and I didn't mind paying for that. But in terms of new stuff, I just read it in the app, and, you know, 75% of it I don't think is very good or is average, so I don't pay anything more to collect the collected editions. And only when every once in a while, when a series that I actually really enjoyed and want in a permanent, you know, form, then I actually purchase it. But it's certainly cut down on my purchasing of Marvel.
Yeah, I think a higher percentage of people that are using the digital component are relatively newer to comics. I think a lot of folks who have a longer history, by and large, don't switch from a physical medium to digital. That's not an absolute. There are plenty of people who have made the switch, but there's a lot of people, like I said, that come in here that are saying if they're going to go to, you know, a digital model, then I'm done reading new Marvel. I'll just go and read the stuff I have at home and enjoy my old stories, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a dangerous place to go, because you are alienating a core of your business that really is your Wednesday Warrior, who really does essentially pays you to be an IP farm.
Yeah. Well, I completely, but one question I have for you then is, in 40 years, those people will be dead. So what, you know what I mean?
I think it matters less how long they live than how long somebody like Dan DiDio stays in power. And the reason I say that is he's a real strong champion of the Wednesday Warrior concept and getting people to buy the weekly stuff. And that matters deeply to him. And I'm very appreciative that it does. But if for some reason he were to do a complete 180, which I don't think he would ever do, but if he did a 180 on that and said, you know what, okay, we're seeding that market, we're stepping back, he could literally flip a switch, theoretically, turn on a DC equivalent to the Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited, and then for the $5-$10 a month for Marvel, another $5 or $10 for DC, it could theoretically implode the retail landscape, because again, what we've seen on these charts is so much of the material flowing through the system is Marvel and DC. And if you've got a lot of people saying, you know what, I'm fed up with the delays, I'm fed up with the price, I'll wait till it's 6 months later and I'll pick it up online. That's one person, and not just literally Dan Didio, there's obviously everybody else over at DC and Power and stuff, but that to me is the thing that is the next major kind of boulder to drop into the river, if you will, that could just forever alter the comics landscape in an irrevocable manner and do it in the span of maybe 2 to 4 months, should it ever happen.
Well, and obviously it's anecdotal, but I have a very personal story that goes along those lines. Marvel raised prices. I just kind of stopped buying Marvel. I got the deal to come into the Unlimited. I bought the Unlimited app. I am more of an old school guy. I kind of prefer paper. I'm not a huge fan of the app, but okay, it was whatever. It was something. I went with that. Then I realized I just didn't like the new stuff that much, and I started going back through the app and reading the old stuff. And then I went, wait a minute, it's not that much more expensive, and I can get the old paper feel again. And now I do 99% of my Marvel reading of the Epic collections. And so it literally went full circle, where I started, you know, buying issues, to they moved me to the digital app, to now I'm going back to reading the old stuff, like Eric suggested, but in the nice, easy to find, cheap trade form.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because I could see if at some point something were to happen that says, okay, either they're not new comics to get or I stopped getting them for whatever reason. I've got tons of back issues that I bought at one point while doing the podcast that I've never actually gotten around to reading. So a lot of stuff that's kind of in my sweet spot of DC of late 70s, early 80s, where they just had some amazing artists, some really talented writers, and a faster story pace than the decompressed stuff comparatively that we get now. I could easily see at some point flipping off the weekly comic spotlight in favor of almost a weekly back issue spotlight on some of that stuff, potentially. I mean, I'm not going to do it now with the amount I'm getting, but if the influx were to stop, there is so much older material there. And it's funny because I think it could drive people to go find through online stores or whatever the back issues in some cases, either in trade or even the individual issues. Some of those aren't that expensive. They're actually cheaper than some new comics are now.
They aren't expensive, but they are a hassle. Yes, My Comic Shop and Mile High, I mean, those places exist, and there's good local stores that have huge, but you know, with Amazon or online discounters or a shop you go to all the time that offers you a decent discount, $20 for $30 for those Epic collections,
you can't go wrong with that. Absolutely.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I mean, yeah, I might be able to save $2 or $3 if I dug up all of that, but the $5 isn't worth the headache of digging up the issues, let alone then storing them. It's so much easier to just store a trade on a bookshelf.
Certainly, if DC were to do something along the lines of the Epic collection, I would very seriously consider getting in on that.
Well, and I had a retailer suggest to me, essentially, DC is sort of doing that with the Silver and Bronze Age collection, or omnibuses, or whatever they're calling them. And
was I that retailer?
And it's funny, Eric mentioned it on the Slack channel and said, hey, you know, because I said something just like that. If DC did a collection like these Epics, I would buy them. And Eric said, you know, they do. And I said, if you can point me to them, I'll order them from you. And I have been ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
One of the discussions I had on the Slack channel with Perseus, I think, was around the Legion. Good jumping on points and stuff like that. Because there's a period of Legion I haven't read, but it's a matter of, and I think some of these omnibuses would fill that. I just need to get organized and figure out what they've collected and what I need and let Eric know.
Unfortunately, they haven't collected much. For the most part, Bronze and Silver Age Legion, as far as nice collections, you're down to the two we've already done back issue spotlights on and not much else.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, I check regularly.
They've got one or two that are more the Silver Age type stuff. I don't know if they made the list here or not, but that's the thing I find, frankly, a little overwhelming with the trades list, is there's so much material by so many different publishers. It's hard to keep track of it. And then what's collected and what and all of that, it's a lot.
Just come to me, John. I can help you through that.
Nice to know.
No, if we can, there's one other thing that I want to talk about on the collected edition stuff, and that's actually, this is really, I'm hoping that TJ can help with this. So I don't think, John, that you read much, if any, manga. And Sam, I don't know if you read any. But TJ, you read a handful of manga titles, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking at the list, and there is there's a ton of Viz books on here. Mm-hmm. We do sell, like I said, we sell a limited selection of manga in the shop here, but what is your reaction to the stuff that's on the list? Does it seem obvious to you that it would be here, or...?
You know, I would definitely say that, you know, the top stuff that I see, you know, once I filter it to Viz, Legend of Zelda, I'm not surprised by, because that has a huge cross pollination with all the kids that grew up in the 80s playing the video games and things like that. One Punch Man is actually something that over the last couple of years has become very popular, so I'm not surprised to see that at all either, as well as Tokyo Ghoul. That's become popular enough that they've done the thing like with the Attack on Titan, where they have like three or four series that are starting to branch off, because there's so much demand that they can start branching off like sub series. Like I think with Attack on Titan, there's like Attack on Titan High School. There's like stories before and after. You know what I mean? Like they're kind of diversifying that.
Okay.
Those are the kind of the most recognizable ones in terms of I've seen a lot of. You see a lot of those stocked in the Barnes and Nobles. You see a lot of those with prominent placement. If you do see a manga section in the store,
Like the next one I see is Boruto. Now that's like the second iteration of Naruto, right?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Berserk is one that we definitely do well here with. We do well with Berserk. We do well. Well, we did really well with Death Note until the Netflix series came out, and then it just tanked. One Punch Man we do well on. Early in the year we did good with Ghost in the Shell. Attack on Titan we do good with. So.
Well, I was going to say, as you accurately pointed out, I'm not a manga guy, but it's funny you mentioned it. Death Note, I've got them all and I've read them all. And One Piece, I still read as they come out.
Yeah. I think, Eric, the hard thing that the thing that I don't have a huge grasp on, but I think is tough for a comics retailer, is a lot of the series that are becoming very successful on the manga side, part of how they're diversifying and like adding to their audience. I don't know if you know what a light novel is. They're just going this light novel route where it's basically like maybe a 200 page or less novel with some like illustrations in it. So it's not necessarily a comic, but it's like, it's this quasi thing that it's almost its own little separate category. And so there's versions of that for Tokyo Ghoul. There's versions of that for, what is it? Seraph of the End, which is kind of like the vampire, hot vampire manga that's currently going on. So there's a lot of that stuff. And actually some of these mangas actually started started in Japan as light novels written by authors who then kind of diversified it into manga where it blew up, and then they brought it back around by writing, you know, more novelization versions and things like that. So that I have much less of a handle on, because I don't really read those light novels, but that has been a big push for some of these more successful ones.
Yeah, I think if you look in previews, I believe it's Yen Press has really done a big push on showing the diversification between the actual manga and the light novels, where they actually have like a 2 or 3 page full listing spread of just the light novels called out as light novels. So
And I think it's just like just like the adult coloring book craze, there's certain publishers have realized there's huge demand, and they may see it in different, you know, they may see it in the bookstore market or in the Amazon market where they're seeing a lot of demand, so they're kind of branching out into that. You know, they know they have a successful property like Tokyo Ghoul or the One Punch Man, and say, hey, can we add a different segment of the market? I just would think, I can't give you certain advice about that, because as a direct market retailer, it's so hard to cross-pollinate that, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, I was just kind of curious on what your take of everything was.
Yeah. No, though, it's just like we talk a lot about in the single issues, the rich get richer, right? So the top of the market here is what you see in the Shonen Jump. You know, the weekly magazine. These are the top titles that you see over and over again. There's even, you know, the reincarnation of Dragon Ball that's come back, a couple of volumes of that, the Dragon Ball Super.
Right.
You see at like the 525th rank, Tokyo Ghoul RE. That's like second Tokyo Ghoul series, a manga series, but it's, you know, it's basically about some of the characters broken off and, you know, their history and things like that. So these are the, you know, these are the best-selling series. If you were to want to venture into it, like you said, you already know that the One Punch Man and the Attack on Titan does well. It's just really hard. If you're doing a direct market manga play, I think it's so important to know what your customers want. It's so hard to order extras to have on the shelf. You know what I mean? Because just don't know what's going to sell.
Yep. Yeah. And actually, John, if you wanted to get into manga, I think you might want to eye up My Hero Academia, because I believe that that is a manga centered around a superhero, a kid who wants superhero powers but wasn't born with them.
Interesting. So, the time or two I've read a manga, the problem I had is they've started going kind of, I guess more authentic would be the way to say it, to where it's read right to left, not left to right.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got like 64,000-65,000 comics worth of experience going the other direction. So it's the muscle memory is just fighting me on that. But certainly that one does sound interesting.
It takes a little practice, but I would say by the third volume you read, you're pretty proficient at it.
Yeah. And I had that same problem, but then I read the six volumes of Akira back to back, and that broke me of that pretty quick. So I can read either way. Akira is like 600-page volumes each; they're very very thick.
Okay.
Very good, but yeah.
But if you ever hear a weekly comic spotlight review with "I don't understand why Batman captured the Joker, then let him loose, the Joker murdered something," start reading those stories backwards.
Like I said, I read some manga, not a lot. It still is problematic for me. I have to think more, you know. For all the comics I read, all the prose I read, all the business books I read, you still have to kind of think about it. At least I do.
Yeah. It's good to see that the manga is doing pretty well, because I know when Chris Marshall and I first started doing the trades episodes, there were a lot of things up at the top of the list, you know, Fruits Basket or Naruto or some of those others. There were a couple I couldn't even pronounce, and neither Chris nor I were reading those things. We're like, yep, don't know anything about it. But it's good, because I think there's a definite audience there, and this is another potential on-ramp to get people into reading, into comics. Even if they just stay in the manga stuff, that's good. That's fine. They're at least reading and enjoying the hobby in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about manga is it's generally a low price point of entry for the amount of content you get. $9.99 to $12.99 for 200 to 300 pages. Sometimes maybe $14 or $15.99, like for the Death Note Black, but you get essentially a double volume with each, so you're at 400-some pages. That's a pretty good price point.
Is there any kind of book, preferably written in English so I could read it, around kind of the manga business model of how are they able to do things like this One Punch Man at the $9.99 for those page count? Obviously, it's being serialized. It's going into something like Shonen Jump and the equivalent over in Japan. I'd be very curious about the business model about that. Particularly, is there any way it could be adapted into the U.S. market successfully?
Have you physically read a manga, or have you only read digital?
I have physically read a manga or two. The last one, the one I know I read was the Cup X Super Noodle or whatever that was Neisner, at least nominated one year.
Okay.
It was about the history of ramen.
Okay, because things like the, was it Jiro Kuwata, Bat Manga, those were, you know, manga, but printed more American style.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest reason for price point is number one, because of the amount of copies that are sold in Japan in the hundreds of thousands to millions, the price point for publishing is very low. Secondly, they're black and white traditionally, maybe a couple of color pages at the front or back for character design. And then third, the paper is of a different quality. It's a little thicker, but it's a more porous. It's a lower quality paper than the gloss paper that our trade, the typical American market trades are printed on, or similar comic, the individual issues. So I think all of those things added together, plus the size, the form factor, if you will, of them, is slightly smaller than that of a traditional trade, because a trade, well, at least the DC and Marvel trades predominantly are almost equivalent to the current comic size.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has to do with just how they're printed. You know, it's easier to print in the same format size, but the mangas are a little bit smaller, so you have, you know, less paper, less ink, all of those things, I think, combined to make it a little bit cheaper package.
And I think creative cost, too.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, sure.
I mean, you're talking 200 pages, but it's 1 to 2 panels per page next to no backgrounds. Right. I can't imagine a manga page takes even the most skilled artist nearly as much time as a American comic book page.
And
yeah,
and
you're not going to be paying six different flatters and colorists and
yeah,
exactly.
And I will say to Sam, there are, in general, that is true, but there are a few artists, and just like in, you know, regular comics, that are extremely detailed and yeah, extremely labor intensive. But the other part of the model is that there's often kind of like what is considered a mangaka, which is the main artist, but he has assistants that help basically yep, a lot of the almost like layout and the backgrounds. And then he, you know, he's kind of almost like an artistic director. And then there's a range of how involved the mangaka. Some mangakas draw the majority of the page or all of it. And some of them have their assistants draw everything except the characters in it. You know what I mean? So there's a wide variety, but there's a lot of ways that they have their production line set up. And they also work huge amounts of hours. That kind of goes along with the Japanese work ethic. They work like dozens of hours. You know, it's not unheard of to hear that the people working on this to work 12 to 16 hours a day when they're the successful ones, because in order to keep the pages coming out quickly, that's how it has to be. So they work very hard as well.
Well, and manga is just a different size kind of a market over there. Manga mm-hmm. shops are as ubiquitous as like over there as coffee shops seem to be here, if not more absolutely. So.
Correct.
I mean, the last time I was in Japan, and that was about 10 years ago now, went to a couple of these things, and they are just packed with mangas, you know, left, right, and center and stuff. And, you know, you go a couple of blocks, and you can get another store, plus there's the equivalent of just the stack of the disposable, you know, here's the weekly, you know, phone book or whatever of it, that you can get at the grocery store, at the bus stop, or subway stop, or whatever. I mean, the material is so ubiquitous, it's so prolific there, that, again, it's orders of magnitude of economies of scale that we just don't have here. Mm-hmm. It's staggering. But that's when you've got a culture that reads, whereas here in America, we don't.
We watch TV screens.
And we all drive to work instead of riding to work.
Yeah, they have mass. That is a big part of it. Mass transportation, which allows them to have time to read. Yeah.
If I could be hopping in a train or something shortly after leaving my house and have the 45-minute or whatever, you know, commute to work, there's so much I could be doing. Even if it, you know, was just either reading or something like that. 5 days a week. That's, you know, half an hour or whatever each of the directions. You can plow through a lot of books, manga, podcasts, whatever in that kind of time frame.
Absolutely.
And driving, I could do podcasts. I just can't read. I'd stay current on my comics a lot easier if I could. But driving would suck, but yeah. You know, that's other people's problem.
You know, in 10 to 15 years, when all the cars are autonomous, then you can just put it on autopilot and read your comics as you drive to work.
Mm-hmm. If I'm not done, just tell the car to circle the block.
Yeah, there you go.
So what else do we have on the top comics list? Or the top trades list, sorry. We're already over there. So tired.
Rick and Morty just continues to kick butt.
Yeah.
Number 7.
Yeah, that seems to have been a good pickup for Oni. Did Miraculous make the list for... I don't think it did. Let me double check.
No, Princeless did from Action Lab down at 1298.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think Action Lab made a good pick getting Miraculous. I've been reading the comic, and it's a very faithful adaptation of the show, complete with using images from the show in it, but because it's a computer-generated cartoon, it works as well as a comic as it does live, not live action, but in action on the show. How about that? I've got a couple of other workbooks or worksheets here, again, broken down by title, which isn't too exciting because there's just a ton of titles. By format, but this is a little bit loose. It's just as good as my system can determine, and they seem to change the abbreviations for the hardcovers, the deluxe and whatnot, quite a bit. I've also got all the different monthly lists, but again, TJ and I have talked about that every month. And I've got also the breakdown by month. And we see some peaks and valleys. Really, we see a peak up around March and on the dollar side in November, but on the unit side, mainly just in March. But really, while there's some fluctuation and there was a peak and stuff, where trades started the year, where they ended the year, isn't radically different. you break it down by publishers, and really we see this is an area where the other publishers are just able to compete so much better against Marvel and DC, just because there's more of them, there's more material, etc. Marvel is typically doing a little better than DC on the trade side, in some cases dramatically so in terms of dollars, in some cases pretty much on par between Marvel and DC. By units, it's a crapshoot as to who's on doing better between Marvel and DC. But this is one of those cases where if you had to bet Marvel or DC or other on the trade side, I would bet other, just because, again, there's so much material there, even beyond just what Marvel and DC, which are the big dogs, can produce. Whereas on the comic side, it's the exact opposite. They get crowded out of the market, whereas they're able to get a foothold on the trade side. And then I've also got the charts for how the breakdown looks between Marvel, DC, and other on a month-to-month basis.
Yeah, I think that the trades is just so variable depending on what's – obviously, you can say that the same thing for the single issues, what's being published. But with the trades, there's just the long tail kind of distorts a lot of what you see.
Well, I think with the trades, because the cadence of release is maybe at best like quarterly, more likely it's every 6 months or something. Whereas on the comic side, it's like every other week sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's easier to see a lot more fluctuation from month to month on the trade side.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, again, the nature of the release cycle and the fact that not only do you have what is released, but so much back material because, like you said, of the long shelf life. Yeah. It's a very different ballgame.
Part of the difference, too, is that if you took the number of titles over the course of the year from the back half, or even the non-Big Two publishers, so include Image, and especially Image, if you were to take the number of distinct series that are going on over the course of a year, you would have a ton more. However, the way it plays out, the way that they're published and sold, is that you may only get 6 issues of an Image series, and then a trade, and then nothing. It may be done after that, or they may go on to a very long hiatus. We see that all the time. Shirtless Bear Fighter, for example, I think was a boom product. That was something that came out, had its run, went to a trade, and that was it. So when you're talking about a trade market, you have the non-Big Two have a distinct advantage over them just by sheer volume of titles going on concurrently, whereas at Marvel and DC, they tend to have a relatively static amount of titles, and if they take one out, they'll add one in to replace it. They'll reboot a title, but they're not having, you know, 17 new titles this month like an Image could. So I think that kind of shows in the trades where the rest of the publishers have a little bit of a leg up because they have so many more unique titles going on.
Well, and also the promotional pushes work out differently because each Marvel and DC only have so many promotional people and so many dollars they can spend. So in every given month, they're only going to push so many titles versus, right. You know, Image is always going to have like 5 or 6 that they're doing a strong push on because that's the launch month for them. Meanwhile, Valiant's going to highlight 1 or 2 of their key books or whatever, as is almost every other publisher. So there's a bit more of a promotional competition, I think, that just plays out differently there. It's fascinating industry to watch from year to year. There have been some times where the beginning of the year is either really high or really low, and the other end is the opposite. Other times where it's, pretty even over the year. Nothing, you know, there's a peak and a valley for an event or something like that, but nothing where it's just crisscrossing and rocketing all over the place with no rhyme or reason. We've had a couple where it's like, this does not look good. Others where it's like, wow, this is great. This year, I think on both the comics and the trade side, some strong sellers. I think, you know, it's a little worrisome looking into the next year, but I think some of that may hopefully just be the results of the legacy, you know, heavy promotion and natural drop-off by like half or something on those subsequent issues that don't have the promotional push. But we'll see. And on the trade side, I think if you're doing comics not at Marvel and DC and you can survive long enough to get that trade out, that's where you start to actually get to not an even playing field, but have a better fighting chance to get out there. into the market. But that's only if the issues you've released have garnered some level of success and acclaim of some nature.
Makes sense.
Yep.
So you guys got any kind of closing thoughts?
Well, I just wanted to ask Eric what he maybe just a couple trends he's looking at this year that he thinks will be important for the industry. Just, you know, he deals with the retailer side day to day. So I know me and you, John, talk mm-hmm. about what we see month to month, but just kind of be interesting to get his perspective about what he's looking for in this new year.
I think the biggest things that we're looking at is what Marvel's going to do. I think a lot of retailers are just kind of stepping back and just seeing how the changes are going to play out. To date, we really haven't seen any difference in the program of how they're running things. We also aren't sure if their personnel adjustments are completed or if there's still going to be some of that. So that's a part of it. Additionally, I think for myself, one of the things that we always keep an eye on is the back issue market. That is, for us, that's one of the bread and butters of our business. And so it's being aware of what comics are being pulled from the libraries and resolicited in collections, what new film property adjustments are happening right now. One of the big ones is Valiant, right? Valiant was bought by was it DMG Entertainment or whatever it is, and then essentially they're kind of owned by or controlled by the Chinese group that came in and purchased the IP for a film franchise. Now, Valiant is a publisher who has tried, pun intended, valiantly to really work with retailers to get their stuff out there. It's just been, for us, it's proven to be a challenge. We've tried really hard and we want to keep trying. It just doesn't seem to catch on out here as much as we would love it to. So kind of waiting to see what Valiant is going to do. And then the other thing that we're watching just from a market trend with comics particularly is we're looking to see what DC is going to look like for 2018. And each year we've been involved with the store has been a little different. We came in at the tail end of the New 52. We then hit the Rebirth relaunch. This year we kind of coasted a long way through the year before we really had any event of any kind. And then we kind of got hit with Dark Knights Metal, which has been great. Doomsday Clock, which has done great. There's going to be Justice League crossover with Snyder coming up. There's just a lot of things going on that with DC that we're trying to see how all of that is going to pan out. So there's a lot of moving pieces that we're just watching for awareness. Now, where I think we'll see the biggest change is probably going to be in that Marvel DC head-to-head. If Marvel doesn't change much, if it's just kind of they just change the curtains, but the window is still the same, I don't think we would expect the sun to shine much differently through it. So if they don't make any real changes to how they're publishing or how they're marketing their product, you know, I don't really see attitudes changing too much towards Marvel. Mm-hmm. However, Marvel has gone ahead and locked in a few exclusives, Donny Cates being a big one, that have brought a slightly different voice to Marvel Comics. So that's good, but we're just kind of watching to see what's going to happen. DC's rolling out their new age of superheroes, and there's some speculation and question on how that's all going to play out. Those are the key moving pieces for us.
Okay.
Interesting. Yeah, I've got some concerns about the new age of hero. Too many of them feel like they're riffing on Marvel properties, or at least can at a glance look that way. When I read them, maybe I'll have a very different opinion. Don't know. And I'm also a little worried about Doomsday Clock going bi-monthly. I don't think it'll necessarily hurt sales, but I think it'll hurt story momentum both for it and the big picture DC Universe stuff. But DC's in one of the stronger positions I think it's been in years. And I think you're right. If Marvel doesn't kind of shore things up and get back onto stable footing and move forward successfully, we could see a definite shift in who's controlling the board, if you will, on the sales charts.
Yeah, I think that, with DC's kind of analogs of Marvel characters, it's going to be interesting to see how the perception from the readership is. Because if readers feel that, I'm not too sure they're going to stick with it as much. But there's no doubt that DC has the momentum going right now. And I have to admit, before being a retailer, I didn't see as much of it, so I can't comment on prior to. But since becoming a retailer and going through Rebirth and just how DC works with us as a publisher to a retailer. It is, they make it very easy for us to do business both with and for them.
Mm-hmm.
They provide us the tools we need. When we have a question or concern, they are Johnny on the spot to respond. I don't have one, I don't have two, I don't have three. I have four people at DC that I can get a hold of very quickly to ask questions from a direct, you know, retailer sales perspective. We have emails for Dan and Jim that we can send them stuff and they'll get back to us in a timely fashion, believe it or not. I mean, it's very impressive how they view working with the retailers. So from not only a story momentum, but just from a partnership momentum, it's really strong. And that's something that I know Marvel is working on. And I think if they can get that, the partnership component really clicking, that will in turn help their publishing component, because we know what they're doing. We know that either they're listening to us and they're making changes, or they're at least letting us know why they aren't making changes. That's almost as valuable. So if Marvel can get that figured out, I think that we'll have a really nice year next year.
I think it's great that you have that inroad into them to say, hey, what about this? How about that kind of a deal? But the question that immediately popped to my mind is, do they ever leverage that in the other direction of, hey, we're going to have a few open slots in our lineup in a few months, and we've got a couple of books. Gee, do we want to go ask the retailers what they think we ought to have, you know?
I think they get enough of that indirectly. They'll get comments of, geez, I wish that Marvel would publish a Fantastic Four book. You know, there's those things come out and they hear that. They don't necessarily directly solicit us. Now, it's interesting that you ask that question, because you kind of have to wonder how much, what would that do, right? What good would that do? Because each retailer is going to have their own micro economy view, where we don't know all of the film futures. I mean, we know the titles of the movies, but we don't know what the content's going to be, what characters may get brought in. So there's things that we don't know. And I don't know how often they go, oh, we've got open slots, what are we going to fill it with? It feels like they have a plan for that side of thing. The things that felt like they didn't really have a plan, or was a late arriving thought, shall we say, would be creating those lenticular homage covers for the legacy relaunch numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That felt very much like DC's doing really good with lenticulars. We're going in. They may have done, you know, 9 of them this year. We're going to do 40 of them, or 52 or 53, whatever it was. That was definitely a feeling of reaction to something that DC did. Legacy also felt kind of like a little bit of reaction of we're not getting that same penetration that we wanted in the market. DC did this thing called Rebirth. Let's do something like that where we go back to the core. So there's certain things that have felt, just timing wise and how little lead time we've gotten on them.
Yeah.
That it's just been a thing. So like for us, when we were at C2E2, which is where the retailer summit was held last year and where it's being held this 2018, we were told about Secret Empire. Of course, at that time, we were told that it was an 8-issue miniseries that didn't have the Alpha and Omega and whatever. But we were told about that. And then we were told there's no more events after that. Well, that changed because Legacy happened. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things where it was literally like, oh, hey, retailers, Legacy's coming. Boom, previews arrives tomorrow. What the heck? I mean, it was sudden and it was jarring. Whereas with DC, they told us about Dark Knight's Metal, and that didn't come for, and this was in April when C2E2 was, I think it was, and that didn't come for, you know, 4 or 5 months, something like that. So we had a long time of building and discussion with them, looking at the Forge and then the casting.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a way to gauge interest, and then we kind of led into it. So, I mean, we had a much longer cycle, so it didn't feel as reactionary. It really felt planned and built. And if Marvel can get to that point where it doesn't feel like it's a rushed afterthought and it's more of a, this is the big plan over the next 12 months, here's where we're going, that will go a long way for us to be able to do a better job selling their product.
I agree with that. I just question if that's possible to have happen in 2018, given they've just had some leadership changes and stuff. It's going to take, you know, a little bit of time to get the lay of the land for the new person, where things are, what the current plans are, where do they want to go, and then how do they adjust course. So at best, it seems like the point at which they could be that level of proactive, it wouldn't be till, you know, fourth quarter at best. I don't know, maybe they can move faster.
Yeah, I guess it depends where the decisions are being made, and I think that's common with any large organization. You have some organizations that like to push the decision making down to the lower levels, to the people that are actually doing the work. And then you have some that like to keep it way at the very top. And then, you know, the high ranking officials under right underneath that executive committee are basically just rank and file order takers. And they have a title and a pay grade that's really nice, but they're really just doing what they're being told. So it's kind of how much autonomy does the publishing arm have and where does that autonomy fall that I think will make the difference as to how things are done.
Yeah, I just would like to see both companies really strong, but also a market that is still very, or becomes much more accessible to the other publishers. Because I think with the amount of Marvel and DC properties on the movies and TV shows, there's a definite kind of consumer that can be brought in that way. But I think there's so much of a diversity and wealth of material from the other publishers that you could take almost anybody off the street and have a fighting chance to say, oh, you're into cooking. Maybe there's a manga for that. Or you're into whatever. Here's a story you might find of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So, cool. So, any other closing thoughts?
I don't think so.
No, I'm good.
I think we're about done then. It's only been, about 3 hours of recording time. We'll see if I can edit this down a little bit. But it's part of the fun stuff of doing the year-end episodes. There's just tons to talk about, lots of material, lots of different perspectives. Thank you, Sam, TJ, and Eric, for being on. Great discussion, and I think with that, we'll call it an episode. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com. under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the monthly question. The Diamond Order Index only goes two decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Math, logic, and English language itself seem to work very differently there.